Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. New York Times bestselling author Miranda July returns with an irreverent, tender, hilarious, and surprising novel, All Fours, about a woman upending her life. A semi-famous artist announces her plan to drive cross-country from LA to New York. 30 minutes after leaving her husband and child at home, she spontaneously exits the freeway, checks into a nondescript motel, and immerses herself into an entirely different journey. Miranda July's second novel tells the story of one woman's quest for a new kind of freedom, part absurd entertainment, part tender reinvention of the sexual, romantic, and domestic life of a 45-year-old female artist. Miranda July is a writer, filmmaker, and artist. Her debut novel, The First Bad Man, was a New York Times bestseller, and she also authored a collection of stories, No One Belongs Here More Than You. The new novel, her second, is All Fours, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Miranda July to the Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What an honor to have you on the program.
Yeah, glad to be here.
I've heard various versions of the origin story of this novel, but as far as you're concerned, the initial thought of how this came to you, which ultimately was out of a short story, right?
I mean, that's where the voice came from. Honestly, when I think back, yes, I started writing at 45, but really from age 40, I started to have this feeling like the road ahead just dropped off, both in terms of like basic medical information about my body, which was weird because there had been so much involvement in my reproductive system, sort of over-involvement, and suddenly that was over, and there was no more kind of imagery or stories of the road ahead. But meanwhile, there was this feverish whisper network among my friends about not just our bodies, but our marriages and our desires. And everyone was questioning everything. And that's around the time when I wrote The Metal Bull. And the response to that from my female peers, other writers and artists, was so intense that I thought, oh, maybe this whispered conversation can be loud. Maybe I can put all of this in the book, the shame, the radical questioning, and it felt like a big risk, high stakes, but I knew I wasn't alone.
The Metal Bull was published in The New Yorker, I think around 2017, and is about a middle-aged woman who in her youth made a porn clip, an amateur porn clip, that for a time caused people to recognize her. What was it like for you to write that story? Obviously fictional, but then how it's responded to?
I remember thinking, maybe you know from my other work, usually the characters are more character-y. Like it's
right.
Usually much more obvious. Like,
yes.
You know, they just don't look like me. They have a different job. And yeah, with The Metal Bull, I didn't do that. It was still just as much fiction as you say, but I had this kind of embarrassment when I remember submitting it to The New Yorker and thinking, well, thank God this won't get published because it has too much sex in it. I'm just sending it in just to sort of show that I'm still writing. And then they did publish it. And I guess the anxiety about being conflated with my narrator or that there was something kind of, I don't know, sad or boring about, you know, a woman my age living a life kind of like mine, it all just kind of went away when other women began sharing their stories with me kind of in exchange, you know, having read the story. And those stories didn't seem embarrassing. They were really exciting. And I was like, huh, okay, maybe I got it wrong about myself. And maybe none of us needs to worry about this, that these stories aren't interesting. Once again, I mean, it's fiction. I had my way with this character, but I also didn't create all the armature that I was used to creating around my fictional characters. I let her have my job. I didn't name her. And then I went ahead kind of loaning you know, loaning my body, as it were, kind of the way an actress does, you know, like we love to see a familiar face in a new role.
In this case, you don't seem like you mind at all if people make the connection to you.
I guess it's like, you know, we've all read all this auto fiction in the right. recent years, and it's has this urgency and excitement. And I always feel, you know, these are some of my friends, Sheila Hedy, not that anyone claims the title of auto fiction writer, but I always feel sort of old school, little Hollywood, because I'm so interested in plot and character and twists and turns and reveals. And I'm kind of envious, honestly, of the of that alive urgency that auto fiction has. So I guess I tried to take a little bit of it. It especially seemed like maybe a more dignified way to approach the fact that it's going to be conflated anyways, in part through my own doing. I mean, not every writer acts in movies that they wrote, you know, like I've heightened the problem. And so it seemed like, well, do something creative with that. Like, don't just whine about it and be like, it's not me, you know, be like, okay, so you're picturing me. Well, let's use that. Let's use that as a interesting tool to make this story feel more immediate.
And as you were thinking about this and considering age and desire and marriage and gender and all of those things, you're also in the process of making Kajillionaire, right? I mean, this is all sort of happening at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was nicely kind of submerged, partly because my focus was on Kajillionaire, but I wrote down little things. Like I had this just dedication and it, without knowing, you know, what was coming in with the new book. I remember actually my producer, Dee Dee Gardner, on that movie saying, like at the craft services table of Kajillionaire, I think I asked her some question about like hormones or something, you know, a kind of wide-eyed young woman. Yeah, I felt like a young woman question. And she was like, ooh, we should do a podcast together about menopause. And I just like stared at her in horror. Like there's nothing I'd like to do less, but she's also my producer. So I was like, yeah, great. And I went home and I wrote that down and I was like, what does she know that I don't? Why was I so horrified by that? Given the fact that I am curious and I asked her questions that she realized, you know, a lot of people didn't know the answer to. Yeah. So these things stuck with me on the kind of back burner and I wrote them all down. Yeah. And then I looked through a few hundred notes and realized like, oh, this is a pretty wide, deep world of themes that aren't going to get boring.
The scene, it comes early in the novel where the character gets off the highway and is at the motel and then suddenly decides to just redo the entire room and spend $20,000 in the process. That is one of the greatest chapters of fiction I've ever read.
That's
just delightful because it sets up just about everything. But it is so, if you take it out as its own jewel, it's just gorgeous.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Yeah. It's funny. I wanted to do that in the kind of unconscious way where you don't realize that this pleasure of redecorating the room is sort of the tip of a much larger iceberg under there, this kind of idea of what right. makes a home and can you create a home in a new way. I think the pleasure of the craft of like the wallpaper and how it would be done, all the intricacies of that. I found an old note recently. I had just read Helen DeWitt's novella, I forget what it's called, but there's a dressmaker in that. And she's making a dress for there's something high stakes about the dressmaking. And I remember what I wrote down was that it stayed interesting, that I couldn't understand why these tedious dressmaking details were not boring me. I kept turning the pages, but it gave me permission. I made the connection to these hotel redecoration scenes I was writing. And I thought, well, if the stakes are high enough, if you feel, you know, in your gut that this matters, then you can get away with that. You can take the reader through that.
The other thing too, is that while, as I said, it can stand on its own because just in and of itself, it's a very funny story.
Right, right. There's a lot of humor to be had there. Yeah.
It tells us a lot about this woman. I expected the character to move on, to continue. And then as we realize that that's not going to happen, and I mean geographically move on, that's not going to happen, this is when we start to learn more about her and more about what she is surviving, how she is feeling. And as she is becoming deeply anxious about the changes of her body.
Right. It is a good container. And the conceit of that she has to keep reporting back on her trip across the country, you know, as she, you know, lies to her husband, and the terrible feeling of lying, but also it kind of takes you further and further down a very personal road, you know, like you're the creator of your fictional world, which, yeah, I mean, I was doing as I was writing it, and then she was doing with her family, I guess, creating space, like creating space in which to consider who she really was now at this midpoint in her life.
Miranda July is our guest. The name of the new novel is All Fours, and it's published by Riverhead Books. We learn of the cross-country trip. We also find out an awful lot about her husband and her child. Talk a little bit about that dynamic, about that relationship.
She mentioned sort of in a matter-of-fact way, and I often tried to present things that made me nervous in real life. I tried to present them as if we all know and agree and understand this. And one of the things was that this creative couple, her and her husband, had been living quite happily in their sort of fairly equal life until she had the baby. And then suddenly this like latent sexism leapt out, not from any one direction, but just sort of all around, that she felt almost fluish with guilt about every single thing she did. And he was sort of quietly rewarded for all the same things. And he had to walk around feeling like a criminal in his own house for not really understanding this. And she, meanwhile, like didn't get to enjoy him the way other women could, you know, who weren't in this bind with him. And, you know, meanwhile, the child is a miracle, like all children are. And so, yeah, it sets up this sort of this tension, you know, like either any, and you can either think, well, that tension is just life. And people suggest that throughout the book. And that is one way to think about it. Or you can kind of keep pulling at it and keep wondering if this is, in fact, the way it's supposed to feel.
The child comes from a very difficult pregnancy and is a birth, which is explored later in the novel. And they are brought in several times to ground both the narrator, but also the family as a whole.
Yeah. And I mean, those sections were such a joy to write, that dialogue with the kid, which is, it's so funny. Like, you know, it's fiction. There's no conversation that actually happened with my kid, but God, I could write that all day, you know, like that sort of exchange that has a slight kind of psychic quality to it. I mean, that increases later in the book, but just, you know, a conversation between two people, one of whom started out inside the other one, you know?
Right. When you think about the characters too, you touched on this just for a second ago, but the friendship you have with Jordy is, or the in the book, mm-hmm. the friendship they have with Jordy is so fascinating because it is you make this is the person I can share anything with. This is the person I can tell absolutely anything to.
I know, which is, it's funny. I think that's what we, I guess I'm saying we women, but maybe for men too, we believe our friends are until we get married. And then there is this strong push to lay that aside and have that person be your partner. In fact, it's sort of frowned upon to get too explicit about your sex life, about your relationship with anyone outside your marriage, except maybe like a trained professional. And that is one of the frustrations of the narrator, is that everyone is so siloed. All these marriages are so siloed that no one knows really what anyone else is doing or how it's working or if it's working. And so change is particularly hard and slow, in contrast to, say, the open sourcing that happens with technology. The shared knowledge, the working together to, like, you know, move things along really quickly, which she eventually does try and do with the marriage. But Jordy is, it's funny, when I was writing a pretty early draft, I remember my editor saying, you know, Jordy is the most fully realized character, you know, besides the narrator. And I was initially, I was like, oh, wait, is that a problem? I mean, she is married. There's, you know, this child. And then I thought, no, I think that's just right for this book. Like, that person needs to be very, very real, because there's something kind of risky and dangerous about making that relationship almost primary, when in fact we're told so clearly that should not be the primary relationship. But there's so much questioning like that about where you keep your real self.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, and this is a wrong way to think about it, but because Jordy is so accepting of everything that the narrator does and talks about.
Kind of. Mostly, I feel like she's a little wiser.
Mostly.
Yeah.
To the point where that helps us as the reader accept, perhaps, for want of a better term, the more unconventional, the more drastic ideas and decisions that are made by the narrator.
Yeah, I guess maybe what I was reacting to is Jordy isn't the same as the narrator, but she does accept the way the narrator is, which I think is kind of a special gift when you're you know, when you're able to say, well, I'm not like that. I actually do revolve around my partner, and I don't want to take these risks. I don't want to lie. It makes me uncomfortable, but you are this way, you know, and I see you, and I see the importance of what you're doing. You know, she only kind of taps her away from, like, certain disaster, you know? I think the phrase is, we wouldn't cheer each other off a cliff. Oh gosh. Yeah. The cliff. There it is again. Yeah.
And that because there is no judgment from that, then that allows the narrator to continue to provide information, because it isn't going to be something where they're going to be judged, or that friendship is going to be fragmented in any way.
Right. I remember playing with that at one point, this, like, falling out between them. That was a dark period of writing. I thought it had to happen for, you know, reasons of tension or whatever. And I was so glad when I realized it didn't have to happen. In fact, like, there could be a lot of other sort of treacherous things to withstand, but that relationship didn't have to be one of them. Yeah.
And the fracturing then comes with the relationship with the narrator's husband.
Right. In, I hope, a new way, in a way that, yeah, she doesn't blow up her life. I think that's a kind of easy phrase, but she's more riddled with fear than a person who would just do that so recklessly. It's a process, which was interesting to... You know, it's like, you don't want to, I'm never interested in writing a book that has a lot of the the real conversations that would have to happen, which right. might include with a couples therapist, which might, you know what I mean? Like whatever, the sort of New York Times op-ed piece about marriage. That's, you know, then I'm suddenly just don't want to write anymore. So having these scenes, these like kind of what we would call in film, like playable scenes, you know, scenes actors want to do, was so essential to me just keeping my curiosity intact through the really tricky process of how, you know, how does it feel? How psychologically do you unbuckle to people in a structure that's so well trusted?
The structure that is so well trusted. Explain that a little bit of that.
Well,
meaning the conventional novel.
I'm actually meant marriage, but we could also say the novel.
Well, there
yeah,
you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is. I tried to question both of them. It's funny, all these sort of polyamory books and articles coming out, I foresee some lumping together with that. And of course, you know, I'm curious about those things as well. It's not in my constitution, I think, nor in a lot of people's constitution to just, you know, go fully polyamorous. But I think, yeah, just sort of even the thing of like, okay, we're agreeing to sleep in the same bed in the same house forever. Like, that's funny. That's a kind of funny, almost like a sort of fairy tale or something, you know, like a sort of old timey thing, given what our lives are like and how much women's lives have changed since that idea was kind of brought. I always feel like I need to quote, like, since 1862, when that idea was invented, but I obviously it was before then and I don't know the date. So I guess I always think the power lays in this kind of subtler version of questioning, not the blowing up version, which you're just in a constant state of reaction to it, you know, of picking up pieces. But these subtler questions, then you yourself become really implicated from moment to moment. And that's, in a way, harder.
Speaking of subtlety, the sexual nature, the descriptions by the narrator of their wants and their sexual desires, that is not subtle. And I'm curious as to what that is like to write about and how to write it.
Yeah. It's funny. Often I wrote quite easily. It was fun to write a sex scene or, you know, a scene of desire or longing or, you know, masturbation, whatever. It's, and then I'd go back later and look at it and I'd be like, is this actually true? Because it's hard, especially if you're someone who, as many of us, like, get off on turning other people on. So it's like a circular, it's hard to find the end of that loop, you know, and separate the mind and body and figure out, like, what is really going on? What is sex? How much of it is a concoction? Could a sex scene not even involve sex as we know it? And then, you know, as a writer, I also started to realize that consummation, if you've successfully built up enough desire, like wound the narrator and all the readers up enough, then that consummation is sort of like money you get to spend on whatever you need most in the book, which after a while I realized I needed it for some pretty challenging things. Like, this book is about aging and to reconceive of how you see older women. Like, if could I consummate that? And so I did. And, you know, that was many drafts in that I realized, you know, that I could kind of spend my sex in that way.
So even as you're describing that, and you used a phrase a moment ago of looking, you know, is that even true? And so as you build this up and you have that to use your term, that currency, if you will, does that buy you truth?
I mean, you got to stay close to the ground, right? You can't just get sort of theoretical about sex, that's not going to work. It's the body. And right. any body reading it can feel the lie, which is kind of great because I get nervous when I get too theoretical. I can't afford more than like a sentence or two that has someone thinking a thought, you know, in a sentence, like in a written way, you know, like I live most in dialogue. I live best in the sort of reality of how people mess up or say the thing they don't quite mean. I think I kept it true because I also kept living alongside the book, and I outgrew versions of the narrator and grew into new ones. And so I had that perspective to write from.
I don't know if this is valid or not, but you're also writing this at a really tough time in our world. I mean, there's what you're going through. There's what the narrator is going through. And then there's what we're all going through.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if anyone will read this book politically, but for me, it is my most political book. The urgency I felt in it, it felt like, let me just take everything I have. You know, I'm not an activist. I'm not going to suddenly have skills that aren't native to me, but I do have a lot of other skills, and maybe I can kind of compress them all into what I do best and throw that rock at, you know, a lot of the most intractable frustrations of this moment, of this sort of borderline fascist moment. Borderline. I don't know. I'm just trying not to say fascist.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and especially for women.
Yeah, especially for women.
Miranda July's new novel is All Fours. It is published by Riverhead Books. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.